Hi, I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass podcast, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, I encourage you to check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books. They're $10 paperback, $2.99 ebook download, including my bestseller, NYPD Laughing in the Line of Duty. On Monday night, there was an NYPD cop by the name of Jonathan Diller that was killed during a traffic stop in Queens, New York. From what I read, there was a vehicle illegally parked. Officer Diller approached on the passenger side, suspected something with the passenger. Maybe he was acting squirrely. Maybe he saw something. He ordered this guy to get out of the car. The guy refused. I think Officer Diller tried helping him to get out of the car. The guy pulled out a handgun and shot Officer Diller in the stomach, where he fell down. The bad guy tried running away, and thank God his partner returned fire and hit this scumbag in the back. It's terrible. St. Patrolman Jonathan Diller was a husband, and he was a father to 1-year-old daughter, and he had 3 years on the job. So this poor young man, just starting his career, just starting his family, is gone. And the guy that killed this poor NYPD cop, now get this, he's been arrested 21 times, 21. Spent 2 terms in New York State prisons, totaling 8 years, and, as we speak, had an open gun charge pending. Yet he still walks our streets. So I'm just wondering, can anyone tell me why? And here's the thing. At 31 years old, the most this guy is going to get is 25 to life. And mark my words, if I'm old enough to live that long, the New York State Parole Board will free this guy. So 25, 30 years from now, while I'm gone, and, you know, hopefully a lot of you guys are still alive out there, this guy is going to be walking the streets. It's just a sad, terrible thing with this revolving door justice system. No one's taking it seriously. The people are suffering. And yet these DAs, these politicians, they just don't care. For whatever reason, they've got their agenda, and it really has nothing to do with keeping us safe. So the shooting occurred, I believe it was in the 101 precinct out in Queens. That's the Rockaways. I think there's 2 precincts that cover the Rockaways. I was a Bronx guy. I know I'm going to get corrected, but I think it's the 100 and the 101. And I remember just before I came on the job, probably 85, 86, there was a cop by the name of Scott Goodell, and he worked in one of those precincts. And he got into a running gun battle with a suspect. And back then we had the 38 caliber 6-shot revolvers. Really wasn't meant to be in a running gun battle. And Officer Goodell ran out of bullets while he was exchanging gunfire with this suspect. He ducked behind a car and opened up the cylinder, you know, ejects his spent rounds, and now he's manually trying to load the 6 shots into his handgun. And back then, this was before they had the speed loaders. A speed loader is like this cylinder where you can put 6 bullets in, and then you just kind of line it up with the cylinder of your handgun and turn this little knob, and the bullets would fall in theory anyway. Sometimes they didn't work, but anyway, Officer Goodell was manually loading his rounds into his handgun, and the suspect ran behind the car and shot him in the head. So the Rockaways, I mean, it's out in Queens, but it's you know, it's no stranger to violence out there, and it's just a terrible thing. So Officer Diller was shot underneath his bulletproof vest, and that's kind of what I want to talk about today, bulletproof vests and how they work. And when I was hired in 1987, I don't know how many years it was probably less than 10 that they started issuing bulletproof vests to cops and then making it mandatory piece of your equipment. And I don't know how it is today with the bulletproof vests, but I can tell you, when I got hired, they were uncomfortable, they itched, they rubbed your skin wrong, and they didn't fit correctly. So what would happen, well, I think if memory serves me correctly, they didn't measure us. It was, they just kind of, you were small, medium, or large. So at the time I was, you know, about 160 pounds, like I'm a medium. Okay. And you got this, you got 2 of these vest carriers. They will, and they had like a Velcro straps, and you slid a panel, a bulletproof Kevlar, that's the name of the material bulletproof vests are made out of, one in the front, one in the back, and they never fit right. They just they were, like I said, itchy. And they were terrible. And I remember, like, not one size fit all. Old timers, I would see, like, some of the older guys, like, that had put on weight over the years. You got some obese cops. I would see them struggling to put their vest on, and there would be, like, on their side several inches of exposed skin. So, because the vest didn't just fit right. And I used to say to myself, God forbid this guy gets into a gun battle, someone can slide one right between the vest panels. No matter how many times you wash those things, the guys that used to be on the job will realize this. When you would wash, you would take your panels out because they would stink after a while. So you would take these Kevlar panels out, and you were supposed to, they weren't supposed to be exposed to sunlight. And they weren't supposed to be submerged in liquid, so it was just like a damp rag with some soap, and you were supposed to rub it on and then quickly, like, rinse it off, but the panel was not supposed to get soaked. And you could take the carriers, and I don't know what kind of material they were made out of, but it definitely wasn't cotton, and you throw it in the washing machine. And no matter how many times you wash those things, I mean, you're wearing that vest 5 days a week in the summer underneath your heavy-duty uniform, they would turn yellow. So they were really disgusting. And then what would happen is, after a while, the Velcro straps would wear out. So you'd have, like, one strap that barely held on. It was a mess. And guys would complain all the time, but, you know, you never got anything for free from the department. But a funny thing happened. So I guess I was in auto larceny. This has got to be about 94, 95. The Spanish woman would appear. And she was showing up at, like, every precinct in the Bronx, which means she probably showed up in Manhattan, everywhere else. You would give her your bulletproof vest, and she would trace it on a piece of paper. And for $25, she'd come back a week later with two vest carriers that you could put your panels in. And they were blue, so A, they didn't stain. They were a better quality. And it was just nice to have those things. I mean, I went, like, 7-8 years with the same two vest carriers. And you never knew, it's before the internet, so you never knew where to buy them or anything. This lady, I used to see her in every precinct, the NYPD imaginable. Probably she made a lot of money before the job caught wind of what she was doing and ran her off, because they're very territorial with that. So they're like, well, that's not an official department issued panel. So God forbid if you got into a gun battle and the bullet got past your vest carrier, we're not going to indemnify you. Well, the thing that they gave us wasn't going to save you either. Like I said, it was like $25, and she made a lot of money with it. When I was at patrol, and even when I went into the specialized units, there was a lot of the old-timers that didn't wear their bulletproof vests, even in the wintertime. And I just used to say to myself when I was a kid, you know, running around, like, wow, why aren't they wearing their vest? And they didn't. And I just used to say, well, you know, how ridiculous is that? But here's what happens. As time goes on and you get lazy and you've been involved in a million things, it's a good thing to feel immortal as a cop, because you won't hesitate at the moment of truth and you'll be effective. But at the same time, you can make bad decisions that can impact your life forever. And that was me. I got lazy. I felt immortal probably after 8-10 years. I'd been involved in a lot of things. Nothing happened to me. Nothing was going to happen to me. So what happens? I don't wear my bulletproof vest. And there was a lot of guys in my office that didn't wear it well, and it was stupid thing to do. I look back at it now, how incredibly lucky I was. So the cops that are listening out there, listen, I get it. They're uncomfortable. Wear your bulletproof vest. It's just something that could save your life. And when I went into organized crime, you know, I'm out of uniform. So for the most part, I'm in jeans and sneakers during the week. And with the NYPD, when you work in OCCB, which is called Organized Crime Control Bureau, which covers all these specialized units like the Auto Crime Division where I worked, probably about 10, 15 times a year, you're going to get flown out to different demonstrations, parades. It happens. You get thrown in uniform. It's called getting thrown in the bag for the day. And coming from the Bronx, for us, the worst was to go out to Coney Island. So we would get flown out to Coney Island on Memorial Day and Labor Day. And it was a pain in the ass because, A, it's like an hour ride. There's no shortcuts to Brooklyn from the Bronx. B, you really don't know anybody out there. You don't know any of the bosses out there that'll take care of you. And when you work the Coney Island detail, I mean, you're out in the sun. You're out in the beach. You're along the boardwalk. You've got to contend with that friggin' ridiculous hot dog eating contest, or they stick you over by the freak show, and you know it. The freaks that come out with all the piercings and the nose rings and everything else—they're bad enough. But the people that come to see the freak shows, that you should say. Or, you know, you might be lucky enough they put you, so like Coney Island kind of backs up to this neighborhood called Brighton Beach, which is all Russian. And you had like the little cafes, which you knew it was organized crime. Like the Russians were kind of in a lot of ways like the Italians, like they would have their social clubs. And you'd be standing, I forget the name of that street, it's under the train. And you'd be out there and an officer, come in and have a drink, yes? And I'm like, nah, I'm good. Like, I think the only time I used a bathroom in one of those places. But anyway, it was a hot day out there in Coney Island, and it was a long day. You get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you wouldn't get dismissed if there was a shooting or something that night. You weren't getting cut till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Then you had to drive all the way back up to the Bronx, take your uniform off, and then go home. So you might not get home till 4 o'clock in the morning. So one year I'm working the Coney Island detail. It's probably like my 18th, 19th year. And, you know, four or five guys, we pile into a car, drive out to Brooklyn. We find a parking spot. We go to whatever street, Bath and something street. And when the NYPD has these details, you know, for demonstrations or parades or like the Coney Island detail, they line you up in groups of eight to get a head count. And there was probably over 1,000 cops there. And they're doing the head count. We're in lines of eight. And before I lined up, we're getting out of the radio car, and one of the cops says to me, hey, Vic, throw your vest on. I says, I'm not wearing that thing the whole day. And my buddy goes, I'm not either. He goes, but at least wear it for the head count. And that's the first time anyone had ever said that to me, because I many times had worked details in uniform without my vest. I go, no one's going to see anything. He goes, all right. So Nostradamus. So what winds up happening is we're in lines of eight. There's like 1,000 cops there, right? And you know, we're starting to get our assignments, so now the lines are breaking up and guys are going in different directions. And here comes this deputy inspector, old-timer, and he cut through a group of cops like Moses parting the Red Sea, like just focused in on me, and I'm like, what the fuck does this guy want? Just kind of push guys aside, walks up to me, I felt like I was in Catholic high school again, takes his finger and pokes me on the chest, and he goes, detective, where's your bulletproof vest? And I said, you know, boss, I says, I left it in the trunk. He goes, really? He says, okay. He goes, it's 8:45. He says, you have 1 hour. He took down my name and shield. He asked me for my tax number. He goes, you got 1 hour. He goes, if you don't come to the temporary headquarters vehicle, he goes, I'll be in there doing some paperwork. If I don't see you in an hour with your bulletproof vest, I'm going to stick one in your ass, which means a command discipline where you can lose up to 5 vacation days. I said, okay, boss. So I walk away from him, and everybody's laughing. Like, all my friends are laughing. They're like, I told you. I said, yeah, I know. And I didn't bring my bulletproof vest. So he goes, what are you going to do? I says, watch. So I said, let's go to the precinct. We walk over. I think it's the 6-1, the Coney Island precinct. It's under the L. Or maybe the 6-0. Anyway, I don't know, Brooklyn. I walk into the station house, and there's this young cop working the telephone switchboard, the phones, when you first walk in. So I walk up to him. I go, do me a favor. He goes, yeah. I go, stand up. And he stands up. I go, you're about my height. You're about my weight. He goes, yeah. I said, you want to go to the auto crime school? And his eyes lit up. So the auto crime division, we had a school. It was a week-long course where precinct commanders would send their cops to learn about auto theft, techniques of auto theft, what to spot auto theft. It was actually a pretty good course. I mean, once you're in the auto crime division a while, it's kind of like kiddie land. But I mean, for a patrol cop, it's a big deal to go to the auto crime school. But most of all, what cops love going to that auto crime school is it's a week off from patrol, right? And the auto crime class, it's 5 days, but there's 3 college credits. Like, guys would shoot their mother for those college credits, because in the NYPD, to become a sergeant, I think you need 2 years of college. So, you know, guys have, you know, guy did 6 months, took a couple of courses in college. When you get promoted, you can take the sergeant's exam, but if you don't have those college credits by the end of your probationary period, they'll demote you. They'll just, you know, I hope you enjoyed being a sergeant, and they'll take your sergeant stripes away from you. So guys will beg, borrow, and steal to take these bullshit courses to get these college credits. And I was just talking to a buddy of mine on the phone, and we were talking. I was telling him what I was going to talk about on the podcast, and he goes, "You know, that almost happened to me." And I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I was 6 weeks away from getting demoted." And I says, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I got a phone call from the educational tracking unit." Typical NYPD to create a unit. He goes, "I go down there," he says, "and on the wall is like, it's like a command center." And he goes, "They've got like a big whiteboard." He goes, "With guys' names, the test they took, how many college credits they had, and how long they went until their probation was up." He says, "So they told me, you need 3 credits. So what he did was he went to the auto crime school, got his 3 credits. And was promoted. But funny thing, he was telling me that story. He says, when he walked, they wouldn't really let him in the room. And I said, "Why wouldn't they let you in the room?" He goes, "Well, apparently some NYPD guy figured it out, snuck into the educational tracking unit and attempted to squeegee his name off the wall. Someone caught him, and I think he got demoted. But anyway, so there's an educational tracking unit. So the cop says, yeah, I want to go to the auto crime school. I said, "Tell you what, go downstairs and bring up your bulletproof vest." And he's just looking at me like I'm crazy. I'm like, "Listen, just get your bulletproof vest." So he comes upstairs with his bulletproof vest. I says, "I need this for an hour." And he goes, "Well, what are you talking about?" So I explained it to him. He goes, "Oh, yeah, take it." He goes, "Take it all day." He goes, No, I just want it for an hour." So I go into the bathroom. I throw on this kid's bulletproof vest, button up my shirt, get my uniform together, go to the temporary headquarters vehicle, knock on the door. And I'll never forget this deputy inspector. He was a nice guy. I mean, he was looking out for me. He's having his bagel and his coffee, and he's doing some paperwork. And he goes, "Ferrari." He goes, "All right, let me see." Pushes me in the chest, and he goes, "Okay, fair enough." He says, "Carry on." I says, "No CD." He goes, "No CD." He goes, "I hope you didn't borrow that." And I just looked at him like, son of a bitch. Like, how did he know? So I said, "No, boss, I didn't." I went back to the precinct and I told the cop. I said, "I'm going to need this for a little while." He goes, yeah, no problem. But I returned it to the kid. I got his tax number and his shield number. And I talked to the guys running the auto crime school. And I was able to get him in. So speaking about bulletproof vests, my teenage nephew all of a sudden starts taking an interest in my former career and my equipment. So I'm telling him about the bulletproof vest. And he interrupts me. And he's a really smart kid. This kid's a genius. But he goes, "You know," he says, "Uncle Vic, it's not really a bulletproof vest." I says, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "It's bullet resistant." Now, he's right, but this kid, and I get it, he's a genius, but it wasn't too long ago he was crapping into a diaper, so I wasn't going to argue semantics with him. So I said, "A bulletproof vest makes more sense." He goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "Bullet resistant sounds like a fabric that Billy Mays would be pitching on late night television." So people call it bulletproof vest or bullet resistant. I like bulletproof. So we're talking about how the vest is very uncomfortable. In contrast, after I retired from the NYPD, I become a cop down here in Florida, and it was totally different. So they measured me for my uniform and my bulletproof vest. I'll never forget this. I got my uniforms, and the first day, everybody's laughing at me because it doesn't fit right and everything. But the NYPD, everybody's pants is baggy and the shirts don't fit right because they don't tailor stuff for you and cops aren't going to spend the money to get it. So I'm with my training officer, and she says to me, "All right, put us out on administrative." I said, "For what?" She goes, "Just put us out on administrative." So I said, "Okay." I go over the radio, and car 454 is out at administrative. She goes, "Let's go to the tailor." I said, "Go to the tailor." We drive to a tailor's office. Come in. The guy's got my shoes off. He's got me standing on a block. He's putting chalk down my crotch. He's, you know, "Turn here, turn there." He goes, "Okay, bring your uniforms in. I got your measurement." They form fitted all my uniforms. I look great. I wasn't a cop there long, but I look great. And the bulletproof vest fit like a glove. Like, it was seamless. The material was better. They just down in Florida, they just tend to be more attention to detail, but I guess they can because there's less cops. Unlike the NY, the department I worked for, I think had like 150 cops, which was considered large, whereas the NYPD, depending on the time, is 30 to 40,000. So when I was a rookie cop in field training, the old timers are not going to give you a locker. So it's typical that you see 4 or 5 rookie cops changing out of the same locker. It's crazy. And I shared a locker with this guy, me and a couple other guys. And after field training, I went to one South precinct. I went to the 4-2. He went to another South Bronx precinct. And we kept in touch. We'd go out for beers every now and then. And I actually was friends on Facebook. I still talk to him once in a while to this day. Anyway, he's working in the South Bronx precinct. He's working at midnight. And I think they run a plate or they come across a stolen car. They try to pull the guy over. Goes into a lengthy car chase. The guy crashes the car. 99.9% of the time when someone crashes a stolen car, they either give up or they take off running. This guy was a crackhead and had just gotten out of prison, so he was jacked, in really good shape, high as a kite. Instead of running away, he turns and charges my buddy, who now is getting out of the car with his .38 caliber revolver in his hand. And I guess that took him by surprise because the guy picked up his head. He goes, he was on me. Starts fighting with this guy. The guy is able to wrestle, and my buddy is a big guy. He's well over 6'3 and over 200 pounds, so this guy must have been jacked. Gets his gun away from him and points and shoots my buddy in the chest. And my buddy falls down, and his partner comes running over to tackle him. And his partner was a shorter guy. The bad guy gets my partner's my buddy's friend in a headlock, and he's trying to shoot him in the head. And as he's trying to shoot this cop in the head, the cop is spinning, fighting him with every, you know, everything he's got left. And the guy, he's already hit my buddy with one shot, so he's got five to go. He's squeezing shots past this kid's head, and he keeps missing. Cops that responded lit him up, and I think now he's a shopping cart. What winds up happening is my friend gets shot in the chest. It's in the newspaper. I said, oh, shit. So that night, I think I did a day tour. That night, I went to the hospital. And he's in the room by himself. Like everyone had left. I had come hours later. So they got him hooked up to an IV and everything. And I'm like, you know, I'm a rookie cop. And here's the thing with NYPD cops. I'm sure it's with cops everywhere. Everybody knows there's that chance that you can be into a shooting. You know, it can happen to you. You can kill somebody. You can take someone's life. Someone can shoot at you. You might have to hurt somebody. Cops are like kids. When it happens to one of your friends, you got to know everything about it. You just do. It's like it's preparing you for something that could happen. So I went up to see him, and I'm asking him a million and one questions. And he says, when that guy got the gun, he goes, you know, I'm wrestling with him over the gun. He goes, he got it away from me. He says, he just stuck it in my chest. And he goes, and he pulled the trigger. It was so loud. It was, my hearing went for a second. He says, but then it was like, someone hit me in the chest with a baseball bat. He goes, I fell over. He says, and I couldn't breathe. He goes, I felt like I was drowning. He says, because I couldn't, air wasn't coming. It was like getting hit in the stomach, the hardest I ever been in my life. He goes, it was just so much pain. He goes, and I'm trying to breathe and I can't. And he says, and then I'm kind of like out of it. And he says, I see that he's got my partner in a headlock. He goes, and I can't get up. He goes, I'm trying to get up. He says, but I can't breathe and I can't. So we're talking and everything. And I'm just about to leave. And I said, can I see? And he goes, what is it with everybody? I go, what do you mean? He goes, everybody that's coming to see me today wants to see this goddamn wound. He goes, yeah, you want to see it? And he opened up his gown, and it was like, oh, it was all purple and black and red. It was like, oh, my God, it was the worst wound I had ever seen at the time. But he healed. He recovered. He became a detective. He did well over 20, probably did over 30 years on the job as a detective. Really great guy. I'm not going to say names or anything, but, you know, he's very lucky to be alive. And speaking of lucky to be alive, his partner, the guy that was in the headlock while the guy was throwing shots at him, earlier that night before they turned out, so in the NYPD, you have roll call, and sometimes the sergeants are sticklers. They'll inspect your equipment. They want to see, did you bring your nightstick? They want to see if you have your handcuffs. I mean, sometimes they just do it to check boxes. Other times you got guys that are sticklers for things. One of the things you're supposed to carry in the NYPD, which no one does, is a whistle. You're not going to be doing traffic control in the Bronx on a midnight, but they want you to have that whistle. So I guess this kid knew that this particular sergeant was going to bust his balls about this whistle. So he went into his locker, grabbed a whistle, and stuck it in his pocket. A lot of guys have like a clip thing on the side for the whistle, but he put it in his pocket. So while that guy was throwing shots at him, one of the rounds ricocheted, hit the whistle in his pants and ricocheted, grazed it. Now, I don't know if the whistle stopped the bullet from going in. I doubt it, but it definitely ricocheted. And this cop didn't know it. So he's in the hospital getting checked out. And from he told me the story, he goes, he reached into his pocket to get a buck to throw it in the soda machine. He says, and he cut his hand. And he goes, what the hell is this? Sharp piece of metal. It had basically disintegrated the whistle that was in his pocket. So you never know where a round is going to go. Not only cops wear bulletproof vests, and I can tell you in making arrests throughout the years, bad guys wear bulletproof vests. And there's been a couple of times we've grabbed guys that wear vests. And I remember one time, one guy we stopped. I don't think he was armed. I don't even know if we arrested him, but he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And I go, why are you wearing a bulletproof vest? And he goes, I got a lot of enemies. I says, well, I got a lot of enemies too. I says, but I don't wear my bulletproof vest off duty. But anyway, there was this well-traveled Manhattan cop that was no stranger to danger. He had been transferred to a couple of different precincts. A lot of the guys in the precincts that worked with him knew that he was shady and kind of stayed away from him. He was one of these guys that after the 4 to 12, he went right home or went to wherever he was doing. Nobody really knew a lot about him. And the cops in his precinct arrest a guy that's wearing a stolen bulletproof vest from his precinct. And after they debrief the guy, he tells them that this cop sold him the bulletproof vest. So that was, I don't know if that was the final nail in this guy's coffin, but it was one of many nails that got this guy thrown off the job. So on a side note, getting off the bulletproof vests, P. Diddy or Puffy or whatever his name he wants to be called these days has been in the news a lot. I'm sure more will come of this. I just was thinking of a funny story when I was reading an article about him. So like December of 99, P. Diddy is arrested in a fight in a club that leads to lead flying, right? And then I think there was a car chase. Him and his entourage try getting away. The NYPD pulls over his vehicle. I think there was a gun involved. He gets arrested. I think his driver gets arrested. I think J-Lo was in the car. I don't know what happened with the case. I don't know if he was acquitted. But I remember it was a big thing in the paper. So in the NYPD, if you get arrested with your car and the car is involved in the crime, the arresting officer is going to voucher the vehicle and they're going to send it out to the Whitestone Pound. So Whitestone Pound is out in Queens. It's in the flight path of LaGuardia Airport. The old pound was like about a mile away, and it was in a swamp, and it was right next to an old abandoned amusement park. And whenever you'd bring a car there, you had to move around quick because if it rained, you'd start sinking. Like literally, you'd be ankle deep in mud. So they moved the pound closer to LaGuardia Airport. And it's huge. I don't know how many acres this is, but it's acres and acres and acres, and there's thousands of cars, motorcycles. And when the Auto Crime Division does a search warrant, it's like a chop shop or a junkyard, we take stolen motors, fenders, doors. That's evidence. And we're not going to let the bad guys keep it. So what we had this thing called a rack truck. It was a big truck, and in the back it had like this mechanical arm or claw. It was hydraulic. And guy would stand on the side of the truck with this device and he would operate it. He would pick up the motor and drop it on the ground or pick up the motor and put it in the back of the rack truck. So I wasn't there, but one of the teams in auto crime, they're out at the pound and they're unloading motors and auto parts at the pound. And for whatever reason, the mechanical claw loses its mind and starts swinging around. And they were dropping off these parts next to P. Diddy's, I don't know what it was. It was an SUV. I don't know if it was a Navigator, a Cat, an Escalade. I have no idea what it was. But the claw did a lot of damage to his vehicle. So I don't know what happened to that. I know the supervisors, the Auto Crime Division were like, you had the whole pound to drop off these parts. And you know, the detective was like, that's where the guys that work at the pound told me to drop the stuff off. And it's not my fault. This claw lost its mind. It could have killed somebody. So that's my story about P. Diddy's vehicle. So as always, I want to thank everyone for tuning in, especially my friends in Stamford, Connecticut, Prince Rupert, British Columbia, Langley, British Columbia, Whiting, New Jersey, Frankfurt, Hess, which whatever that means. If you work in law enforcement or have an interesting criminal background or would like to be a guest on the show, drop me a note on Twitter or Instagram, at VicFerrari50. For those of you watching on YouTube, please, please, please hit the subscribe button and you'll get notified every time a new episode is out. Also, if you could, please hit the like button. I appreciate it. Same as you guys listening, just listening to the podcast. If you could write a review, I would appreciate it. If you enjoy the content, check out my Amazon auth page. Type in my name, Vic, Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my books for free, including my bestseller, NYPD Law and Disorder. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll have another episode out next week. Thank you.